Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, the podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and I am convinced the Sopranos universe would be in a better place if this movie and The Many Saints of Newark switched places.
What?
I don't even follow that
thinker.
One.
That's a thinker.
Joining me today is Devendra Hardwar.
Excuse me, is the chef here Puss in Boots?
And Jeff Cannata.
I'm Jeff Cannata, and I love sleeping in a hammock.
Ooh, yeah.
Those are all vague and oblique references. In fact, today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Tony, newest film by Matt Johnson. Two movies in 1 year, guys. One of which we actually already loved.
And also, all of his movies are bangers. Every one of his movies we've loved. So,
well, yeah. The question is, will this one be? We'll find out during our review later on the Filmcast. Of course, before that, we got some what we've been watching for you coming up. So let's just get right into it, folks. Let's start talking about what we've been watching this week. This week, I had a chance to watch a movie called Mutiny. New film by Jean-François Richet.
Usually when you say, I had a chance... it's more sort of just a turn of phrase.
Mm-hmm. It was, in fact, a chance.
This was literally a tiny window of a chance.
Well, I think you're referring to the fact that Mutiny was accidentally released online on Amazon Prime Video for a short window of time. But I would never watch a movie under those circumstances. I always would go to the theater for a film like Mutiny.
Oh, pardon me.
I also feel like you're burying the headline here because we don't care who it's directed by. We really don't. Who does it star?
Well, it stars Jason Statham.
There we go.
But also, okay, here's the thing that really kind of kills me is Jean-François Richet made a movie called Plane.
Yeah.
We all liked it.
We reviewed on this podcast. We enjoyed watching this movie, Plane, when it came out in 2023. And originally, there was supposed to be a sequel to this movie. I believe it was supposed to be called Boat.
Ship. And was it Ship?
Ship? Sorry. I apologize.
Remember the joke where you didn't have to say it was Plane 2. You could just say it was Ship. And you're like, oh yeah, the sequel to Plane.
How dare you sully the memory of Plane.
I apologize. I was like, that Boat does sound kind of silly as a sequel.
Boat's not a great
thing. But that's a true story. Oh wait, no, it's actually Ship. I apologize. Yeah. Ship was reportedly canceled after Gerard Butler decided that he didn't want to do it anymore, which is kind of a bummer.
Ship that movie.
Jean-François Richet decided, hey, I still got that ship energy in me.
We have a script here.
I gotta get this ship monkey off my back. And so he decided to make this movie called Mutiny, starring Jason Statham. Now,
not as good a title, let's be honest.
I would agree. I think Ship, or as it
really,
was in my headcanon, Boat, was more evocative.
Dave,
it
really
it says
everything.
Dingy.
But what happens when a movie like this is available, right? Does somebody set out the bat signal? It's just like a curled bicep. Statham! Get a Statham on the script, please! Please, somebody save this movie.
There's a list, and it has Gerard Butler. And then literally the next name down, you just put a line through Gerard Butler and you move down to the next line of your list. Hi, there's Jason Statham, everybody.
There he goes.
I mean, Jason Statham has been basically making the same movie for the last 10 years, right?
And he's admitted to this, by the way. Have you heard his reasoning? It's just like, I have no range, man. Like, This is what I do. Just let me keep making movies.
Well, it's not only that he's playing the same kind of character, it's that literally the plot is identical.
The same.
And that is, he's a beekeeper. He's a working man. He's a whatever. But actually, he's secretly a skilled assassin. That's really...
He's the Charles Bronson of our era. We don't need an explanation, right? Like, he shows up and he shoots fellas. It's fine.
Yeah.
Well, in the movie Mutiny, he plays a bodyguard. That's who he is. And then in the opening...
Wait. You don't even have to tell us anything. Let's construct from the title, and Jason said, let's construct this movie in our heads, right?
Like, well, it actually takes a big twist.
He's a normal guy. Seemingly normal guy.
Seemingly normal bodyguard.
But But he has a particular set of skills.
That's right.
Somebody
you got that.
Invades the boat.
He's the only guy left
who could possibly do the thing.
The only guy left. And are there some innocents? Are there some particularly, I don't know, really innocent innocents?
Yes,
like maybe
so
a girl or a child of some kind?
Wow. It's actually uncanny how much you're nailing this right now. Everything Devendra just said is accurate.
It's almost like Devendra has watched any one of Jason Statham's movies.
And I love them. I do love them.
It's so true. But I will say, in my opinion, every time he makes one of these movies, they get a little bit better. Like, in my opinion,
not always.
Shelter is better than Working Man, is arguably better than Beekeeper. Not really, actually. Beekeeper is probably better than the other one. Anyway, in Mutiny is probably the best one out of all the ones I just named, right? In my opinion.
I don't know. Does he punch a shark in the face?
No.
That was pretty good.
No, he doesn't punch a shark in the face.
And we got two of those. Yeah.
I don't really consider Meg a Statham vehicle. I know he's
a normal guy.
He's a protagonist, but like really the shark is the star of those movies, in my opinion.
It's true.
Devendra's template applies directly to Meg.
It still applies to that.
That's true. Anyway, Mutiny. Jason Statham is a bodyguard. In the opening scenes of the movie, the guy he's supposed to be a bodyguard for dies horribly.
Terrible bodyguard.
And then
is he framed for this?
That is correct.
Oh my God. Oh man.
And he ends up on a ship needing to fight himself off some bad guys. Now, I will say one of the disappointing things about setting this on a ship is there is literally a limited number of guys you can have fighting him over the course of the film. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, some people would call that a limitation. I would call that an opportunity, you know, just to really restrain.
Right. Like in a normal movie, there's like literally unlimited, you know.
Sure.
He could fight a million dudes. But in the ship, it's only a couple dozen total potential dudes.
Well, unless another ship appears and uses more dudes.
That's true.
There's always more compartments of the ship.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. And other ships could come along. That's right, Devendra, which is a thing that kind of does happen during the course of the film. So
never would have guessed. Yeah.
But I think the action scenes in this are solid. I think I think there is an okay. Actually, no, that's not true.
How does it compare to Plane?
I think there's an okay plot to this movie, but I actually don't think it's true. I think it's really ridiculous. But it has some decent action. It has the pleasures of Plane on ship.
I would argue that the pleasures of Plane are
tell us
the fact that it Plane to me
rose
above what I expected. It was not just the Statham-esque, you know, you got to turn your brain off to enjoy the action sequences. It was actually, hey, there's a smart guy doing some real smart things trying to deal with this whole plane situation.
He was a good pilot with a particular set of skills. And also that was a two-hander because we had Mike Coulter in that one too. And I love Mike Coulter.
But it's like they had this plane out in the middle of nowhere and they got to get it. And there's dudes coming at them. What are we going to do? And it felt like a real clever, the premise was not just, you know, it was actually a clever kind of puzzle that this main character was trying to figure out. And
he was
directing everybody to do the thing, and we're trying to it was like, wow, this is actually quite a large step up from just a kind of rote action premise. It's actually
it was competence porn. Like Plane was also competence porn in addition to being an action movie, because the whole setup of that movie was like, oh man, look at all the stuff it takes to get a plane ready, getting everybody on board, the sort of like physicality of being a pilot and just living the life of that movie did at the very beginning.
Wow, I think you guys liked Plane a little bit more than me. I mean, I enjoyed Plane a lot as well.
I thought it was cool.
That's cool. That's cool. Yeah. Okay, in that case, you will be disappointed if you watch this film. Because it doesn't really have any of that. It's more just Jason Statham kicking ass on boat.
It is a shame, by the way.
This is a two-hander, by the way. His co-lead is Annabelle Wallace,
who
is the main character of Malignant, the James Wan film. So if you've been like, hey, it's been a while since I've seen Annabelle Wallace in something.
No, she was great.
Mutiny, something you can watch them in. So, sorry, Devin, what were you going to say?
Well, no, when Statham pulls out like a Wrath of Man or something, right? We're like, we're not expecting this, but Guy Ritchie and Jason Statham decide to wake up and make a proper motion picture. It's a time to celebrate. So that's why I'm always like excited to see what Statham does next. You know, I remember watching him in Lock, Stock and Snatch and be like, this skinny dude, what's this guy going to do? And he's ended up being one of our most like dependable action stars. It's amazing.
You know what I cannot get out of my head every single time I watch a Statham action sequence is there was a John Wick documentary that I talked about on this podcast like a year ago or so called Wick is Pain. You guys remember me talking about the documentary Wick is Pain? And they talked about the origin of the gun-fu style that John Wick uses in those films. Mm-hmm. And the reason, the way it came about is there was a Jason Statham movie called Safe that came out in 2012. I don't know if you guys remember this.
Yeah.
But he released a movie called Safe in 2012. And this company, the company that makes the John Wick movies, what they offer movies is like, hey, we'll do all the action for you. Like, we'll supply the guys, we'll do the choreography, we'll, you know, we can even do the filming. We can do all the action for you. And so what they did was they planned out what the action for Jason Statham's movie Safe would be. They're like, hey, Jason Statham, we have this idea. I don't think they called it gun-fu at the time, but they're like, it's like this really cool.
It's a little more complicated. Yeah.
Super complicated where you're like, the gun is a part of you and you're using it in martial arts moves.
Have you seen Equilibrium? It's kind of like Equilibrium.
Yeah. It's like Gunkata and Equilibrium. It's like all headshots. And it's going to be amazing. Like, you're going to love it. And they shot footage where they actually did all this stuff and showed you like what the gun-fu would look like. And Jason Statham was like, no, I'm good. I don't want to do that.
I'm going to not punch people. I want to punch people.
Yeah, I want to punch people. Jason Statham was like, hey, I'm good at one thing, punching dudes. Don't need to do the gun-fu. And literally, if Statham had said,
yeah,
yes, I want to do that, there would be no John Wick, right? John Wick would never have happened because that would have been like a part of that movie instead of, hey, we did all this good work on this gun-fu. Let's put this, and Statham didn't use it. Let's put it towards John Wick instead.
It probably could have been a thing. Like, where do we trace this back to, by the way? Like, I remember when The One was being made, the Jet Li movie, The One.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason Statham talked a lot about, I'm training, man. I am training. I want a fight scene with Jet Li. That never happened. And he trained hard for that in that movie. And I wonder if, like, the idea of trying too hard, maybe he just gave up on it since that movie, which is a shame.
I think what you said, Devendra, which is he knows he is good at. He is very self-aware. He's like, I can't stretch too far beyond the realms of like a typical action scene and typical Statham choreography style. But yeah, I mean, maybe gun-fu would have found a way to break out of Safe, but like,
I think he limits himself. He constrains himself and he doesn't want to do the thing that could be potentially really hard. And that's a shame. I mean, I remember where he came from, but also, have you guys seen the music video that he's in?
I mean, you just sent the link and I clicked on it.
The 1992 music video, The Shaman's Coming On Strong. If you want some pure Statham, Statham in the Speedo. Statham. This is where this guy came from, right? He is amazed that he is an action star. He is amazed that he is in this space. And I feel like he just doesn't want to do the things that could mess that up, right? Like trying too hard to do like a unique thing that is outside the template.
I just wonder like what his net worth, like do you think his cash flow is such that he needs to take the jobs every year, right? Like, because at this point, hasn't he earned the right to take a few chances? You know,
does he want to though?
Earn the right to make a couple bombs?
Like,
you know,
he probably likes the work.
Why?
Right?
Why take chances when you can make Safe?
You can make Safe. Also, it takes a month out of the year.
I thought you were going to say safe money, which I think would have been good as well.
But you spend a month in a year filming a very like, you know, standard action movie. You got the rest of the year off, buddy, to enjoy that money. you can just relax.
This is like saying like no the relaxing. Reason you become a school teacher is like you get the summer off. Why not?
There's no relaxing. You still got to do push-ups.
He enjoys that hustle or something. I see estimates of his net worth between 100 and 120 million, which sounds about right.
Yeah,
I would guess if you have the clarity that it sounds like Jason Statham has,
right.
You go, I have a short window where I can be making action movies because age will catch up with everyone.
Yeah.
And you're just like, I'm going to crank them out. See what I did there with the crank?
I like that as
frequently as I can.
I can't take shelter in a pile of all of the money that I have. I need to be a working man.
That's exactly
right.
And keep
making movies. The beekeeper.
I can't be keepering this money.
I need to make more movies if I want to be keepering this money.
This lifestyle.
Operation yeah. Fortune Ruse de Guerre. Okay.
Or anyway. I will face the wrath of man.
That's Mutiny. It's out in theaters right now. I thought it was fine. In my opinion, way better than Working Man. Probably better than The Beekeeper. You know, something you said during Beekeeper, Jeff, that I can't... There's things that like go through my head when I'm watching Jason Statham movies. One is this Wick is Pain thing about Jason Statham could have killed John Wick by accident. The other thing is Jeff saying basically nothing bad happens to Jason Statham during these movies. Like, he never experiences any conflict. Like, there's never any interesting decisions that the character ever needs to make during these movies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Hard choices, obstacles, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just
he used to make those movies, right? Crank 1, yeah. Crank mm-hmm. 2. Nothing but obstacles.
The
Mechanic, nothing but
Resurrection.
Like, yeah.
No, I'm just joking.
Let's do a Crank 3. Come on.
Yeah. All right. That's Mutiny. It's something I've been watching this week. It's on theaters right now. Devendra Hardwar, hit us up with something you watched this week.
Not too many movies this week, but I have spent a lot of time because it's been very hot down here in Georgia. A lot of time indoors with the kids, and we've discovered the show Ask the Storybots on Netflix, which I know you like, Jeff, quite a bit.
Yeah.
And this actually ended up being like a perfect thing for my kids because we love to watch science stuff. So like the science show on YouTube and everything, anything science related, like my kids are really interested in, you know, how does the world work? How do things happen? How are tornadoes formed? How do planes work? And Ask the Storybots specifically is a really fun show aimed at kids that kind of breaks down world concepts like that. And also ton of guest stars. Kevin Smith just appeared in the one about planes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mega stars popping up. They have a lot of cool inventive songs too. I think the songs are pretty catchy.
Storybots. Sorry. Gets in my head all the time.
If you have a curious kid, and honestly, every kid is kind of like, it's kind of like this. I think this is a perfect show for it. So it's weird. Like, I haven't heard people really talking about it over the last few years, but this ran from 2016 to 2020. There have been some spinoffs, which I hear are not as good, but we're really liking this original run. And hopefully the folks behind this can come back and do more because I feel like there is more of a need for educational content for kids. We're seeing that all over the place, especially on YouTube, but I like having something on Netflix I could just start and play and not have to worry about what YouTube gives me right after. So really digging Storybots. If you have a curious kid, check it out.
Storybots. The thing about that show too is I've learned stuff from it. Like it's not a shallow survey of the topic. It actually kind of gets in there. Mm-hmm. And there's a episode about how cell phones work. And I was like, I actually didn't know some of this stuff. It's not just, you know,
yeah.
Oh, hey, kid, you know, let's talk about the water cycle or whatever. You know, it's not like
the food pyramid.
Yeah, it really gets in there and like mm-hmm. tells you how stuff works, which is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Ask the Storybots is the name of the show. And it's something Devendra Hardwar has been watching this week. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've watched this week.
Well, I checked out a new series from one of the creators of Succession. Writer on Better Call Saul as well.
Yeah.
That it would be Jonathan Glatzer. And it's called The Audacity. This is on AMC, although I'm watching on
Netflix. It just hit Netflix.
Yeah.
Netflix has a deal with AMC that they're serving up a bunch of their shows.
Yeah. But this show is several months old.
This has been a spotlight for me. Like, I log into Netflix, boom, the number one tile that is like on my screen is The Audacity. Yeah. And I've heard good things, Jeff, but what did you think of it?
The tile is not working on you, Dave.
What do you mean?
You said it's been on there telling you to watch it and you haven't listened.
Well, it's...
Listen to your algorithm, Dave. You don't get to make your own decisions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's telling you to watch it.
Honestly, Jeff, here is the actual thought process that went through my head when I saw The Audacity on my Netflix homepage, which is, hey, when this show came out on AMC several months ago, I already made the decision of not watching it in the near future. And so now that Netflix is serving it up to me, I'm like, Netflix, I've already made the decision, man. I'm not going to let you influence me to watch it right now. I might watch it in the future at a time and place of my own choosing.
Mm. You have a stronger will than I have, because I was like, I push button.
That was my thought process, and that was Jeff's thought process. Anyway, okay.
Yes, thank you, button push.
Make me watch thing feel good.
Yes.
Okay, Jeff. Content go ahead.
For brain.
All right, what'd you think of The Audacity, which you watched on Netflix, Jeff?
It has a bunch of people in it I like.
Yes.
Billy Magnuson, who I enjoy quite a bit. Sarah Goldberg.
Playing a shithead CEO, by the way, for like the fifth time? Sixth time?
I mean,
this guy's always cast.
Yeah. I mean, he's a very handsome fella, but also
He's in the next Social Network movie, too.
He's got a punchable face, best possible way. Like, that's a compliment, Billy Magnuson.
Yeah.
Good actor, but I can understand. I can see it. Mm-hmm. He's just like too handsome and kind of too smug, and, you know, it works. Anyway, Sarah Goldberg from Barry is also in this.
Yeah.
Zach Galifianakis is in this. Rob Corddry. I love Rob Corddry. So a lot of people I like are in the show, and it is about, something very pertinent to our times. It does focus on folks in Silicon Valley, in Palo Alto, where I did a play in Palo Alto once and had to live there for several months and got immersed in Palo Alto. And that was before things got really the way they are now, but it was already the way they are now.
What was your experience in Palo Alto?
Very weird.
I mean, it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous piece of the earth. But it is, it is this weird Venn diagram of Stanford people and Silicon Valley people and obscene wealth and a lot of privilege and a lot of, just that kind of very cloistered lifestyle. Again, gorgeous place to live. I lived in someone's house. I didn't have my own house. I was being put up by very wealthy people. So I was kind of in that world very much. And anyway.
Cool.
Interesting place. But I'm sure it's even more now as the .com, that was like, what year was that? It's got to have been 2005 that I was there. So
it's very different now.
So the last crash. Wow.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. by the way, the person's house I was staying at was this husband and wife couple that were both very, very accomplished. The guy, the man, who now it seems like he's probably younger than I am now. But anyway, he seemed very old at the time. He was one of two or three people responsible for coming up with the sound that modems made, that like that protocol, that handshake protocol that old modems made. Like, that was one of the things he invented.
So
he's worth $100 million.
He's a monster, basically, because he could have made that into like a pleasing, soothing sound. And instead it was a
That's the sound of my childhood, Dave. That's
I know, but couldn't have been
I have affection for that.
It could have been like it could have been.
Unfortunately.
Anyway. The Audacity, everybody.
Okay, The Audacity.
Palo Alto. I've watched two episodes of the show. They're hour-long episodes. I still don't quite know what to make of it. And I don't usually
I saw one episode of the show and I thought it was a drag, and I've never brought it up.
It's a bit of a drag.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a drag. And I kept like, it's one of those ones where I kept watching it. I'm like, I want to watch another one of these. And I keep waiting for it to get its hooks in me. And it's not doing anything that makes me go, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
It just hasn't found its footing. And I don't usually like to talk about a show unless I kind of have a handle on what I feel about it. But this one, I'm like genuinely uncertain as to whether I'm going to watch a third episode or not.
I'll tell you the deal with this show, Jeff, is that it feels a little weak sauce. It feels like Succession Light in so many ways, especially when the same people the show is about are right now out there destroying our democracy, really just like setting up the end times of civilization gleefully. So the conflict in the show just feels like, oh, this is, I could just read the news and see that the richest man on earth, who is a technology billionaire, is also a white supremacist and has also owned a social network where he is loudly spouting Nazi propaganda. The show is not as hard as what's happening in real life. You want like drama around the tech world? Go read the new book, The Nerd Reich by Gil Duran, which is incredible. You want to feel like angry about the state of our world and what tech is doing? The reality is unfortunately much more disconcerting than this show.
Yeah, I mean, I kept thinking of Mountain Head, which you guys know is a movie I adore and has lived rent-free in my head ever since I watched it. And you know, I put it, I think, as number three of my top 10. And I think it's almost like moving up in my estimation as I just constantly think about that movie. This show, it lives in the same general, you know, space as that. It's not as nearly as good or memorable. The thing that I think I have a hard time with the audacity is that it is trying to be heightened in that it is trying to parody this to a certain extent. It's trying to be an absurd exaggeration of this world. And it's like, you kind of can't, you know, things are so outsized in this, on this topic and so, untethered to any kind of rational approach to reality. As you say, Devendra, like in the headlines, in the day-to-day reality of what these people seem to be spouting and say, you know, professing as just sort of acceptable truth is just so almost absurd.
One of the most prominent VCs is out there doing lectures about the Antichrist. He's not a scholar of religion. He's just doing lectures about the Antichrist because he really believes in this thing. And also he has like fundamentally like engineered everything to where Trump is right now. So
So it's hard to live in an exaggerated version of a world that already feels exaggerated and unreal. And also it's like, it's not funny. It's sort of ironic and kind of, like I said, like there are tweaks and exaggerations that make it feel like the audacity is trying to parody this, trying to poke fun, make jokes. You know, Zach Galifianakis is in the show. Rob Corddry is in the show. These are comedic actors. And there are moments of, I think, attempted levity, but it is, I'm not laughing as I watch it. I can see that that's satire. I don't know. But again, it's not a show that I've turned off or I'm not interested in. There's a lot going on. There's multiple storylines intersecting and nobody is a decent person, right? Even this, you know, this, the central story is about Billy Magnuson's character, who is this kind of fraud tech billionaire who partnered up with somebody and made a company that, you know, sold for an absurd amount of money, but he didn't really have any talent. He just was a sort of hanger on to this, to the actual talented guy who has since committed suicide. So now he's on his own trying to do the next thing, but is devoid of any kind of actual insight or ability. And on a fundamental level, recognizes that about himself, knows that he's a fraud, and but still, you know, just trying to hustle culture his way through it and do the next thing and prove to everybody that he's not, including himself. The central storyline is that he also has this therapist played by Sarah Goldberg, who is not a billionaire, but recognizes that, you know, sort of services all these tech billionaires in Palo Alto and recognizes that the information that they're telling her is valuable and sort of starts using that for her own ends. But that's just like one storyline. There's also all these other background storylines of other characters. Rob Corddry is this Veterans Affairs lobbyist who's trying to get money from, Simon Helberg from, Big Bang Theory. His name, Big Bang Theory, that guy. And a lot of other things. he's another tech billionaire that's doing a thing. It's like there's a lot going on and none of it really adds up yet. Mm-hmm, and I kind of don't know if I'm going to stick with it. So if anybody has watched more of the show and says it's worth it, I would be open to hearing more. But it's an odd little thing, this show, and probably better, Dave, that you ignored your algorithm and didn't give it a shot.
This show is absolutely juiceless. Like, that's the thing. Like, there's just nothing. I think it's coasting on dramatic lighting and a great cast to, like, you look like prestige TV, right? Like, you're on AMC Plus. Surely you should be something. When the show that's on AMC Plus that you should be watching is Interview with the Vampire. there you go. But this show is also not doing anything that Silicon Valley, HBO Silicon Valley,
right,
didn't already do, and did it successfully as a comedy and also occasionally dramatically. So again, like, I'm not seeing anything here that's new.
Well, that's the audacity. It is available on Netflix along with Interview with the Vampire. Interesting, by the way, that the algo didn't serve up Interview with the Vampire to Jeff Cannata, even though
I mean,
that
it probably
is also
didn't. You just ignored it. So who knows?
My hardware algo served that
Lestat up. Lestat not available on Netflix though. So
no,
like,
Lestat just happened.
I guess you gotta buy that.
You get the old seasons. They make you watch the old season. You're like, oh, I need to get AMC Plus.
Subscribe to AMC Plus. That's how it works.
Yeah, so that's how they get you.
Anyway, the audacity. Let Jeff Cannata know if it's something he should continue watching, and let Devendra know if he's wrong about it being very, very bad.
I didn't say very, very. I just said juiceless. You know, juiceless. Like, I have so many other things to watch.
Indeed. /filmcast@gmail.com. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more and more what we've been watching right after this. I had a chance to watch The Last House on Netflix. This spent about a week or two at the top of Netflix's movie charts. And it stars Greta Lee and Wagner Moura in a movie by Louis Leterrier. Have you guys heard about this movie?
I've heard about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This movie does one thing really well. Okay? Here's the plot of the movie. There's a family. It's Wagner Moura and Greta Lee. They're married. They have two kids. Everything is going great. Having a normal day. All of a sudden, the storms come. They live in Seattle, by the way, so that's actually not a really random, it's not a really rare occurrence. By the way, I knew this movie wouldn't be super great when in the opening scene, it starts raining and there's people in Seattle. They're like, oh my God. Hey, everyone, time to go inside. Hey, honey, time to go inside. No one does that in Seattle.
It's a real LA attitude over rain.
They just deal with it. It's just very normal to have rain and have it. They don't even, you are seen as an outsider if you have an umbrella in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so then they try to leave their house, but they can't. Why? Because there is a thin layer of water outside the house.
Just like Seattle.
Just covering the house.
Yeah.
And I know what you guys are thinking. What? what do you mean, David? It's just water. It's just like kind of magical water. Well, does it like stop people from being able to go through it? Kind of like, is it like solid? Is it like ice? Nope, definitely not. It's just water. Just stops them from leaving.
Okay.
And that is the plot of the movie.
This movie came out, I think it was released the same weekend as Oak Street. So I feel like this is like families going through some crazy shit.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, is it a metaphor? I mean, because, you know, I lived in Los Angeles long enough to know that if a thin layer of water existed, a lot of people would just not go to work.
Mm-hmm,
you
know? Well, this family becomes trapped inside the house for months and months and months, and they need to make life work. And one thing I really appreciated about The Last House is that the movie is an environmentalist movie. So it's about how people are destroying the environment and how, like, this is made very clear in the opening voiceover. They're like a voiceover just tells you what the themes of the movie are. So, like, you don't need to worry about that. It's an environmentalist message. However, completely separate from the environmentalist message, one thing I really appreciate about the film is it really captured what the opening days of lockdown during COVID were like, right? You're inside the house with your family And there are many days when you feel like you're losing your mind. Like, what is even happening? I can't believe we're living in this reality. But if you're part of a family, you're living with other people, there's also moments of joy, moments of humor, right? And ingenuity, figuring out new solutions to these random problems that we're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Well, first question, does the plumbing still work?
Yes,
that's does. That's the most important thing.
Yes,
if you're
does.
Trapped in your home,
okay, it does, and so does electricity for some reason. Yeah. You know. But like no one can leave their houses around you, so they communicate using chalkboards that they hold up to the window and stuff. But yeah, the plot of the movie makes no goddamn sense. When you get to the end of the movie, you do get some explanation for what the hell is going on. And everyone who I've spoken to about the ending of this film finds that ending either completely unsatisfying or truly ridiculous and nonsensical. So it's a very, very silly film. That said, it does do one thing really well, and I have to give it props for that. Because, like, in my opinion, we have very little art that actually engages with COVID and that period of our lives. You know, 1.5 million people died during that time period, and we're not like as far as I understand, as a society, we just collectively feel like we want to move on from it. That's fine, but like and by the way, the little art that we do have, in my opinion, mostly is bad, including this film. What was
that's
that
only
movie?
1.5 million in America, by the way.
Right, like, that's right, that's right.
Much bigger number worldwide.
Correct, yeah. Correct. What was that movie we reviewed? Sick, the Kevin Williamson movie.
Yes, yeah.
Terrible
yes.
movie.
Hated that. Terrible. Movie. Do you guys remember a movie from the '90s called The Trigger Effect?
Yes.
Dermot Mulroney.
Yes.
And Kyle MacLachlan.
What about it?
And I think Elizabeth Shue is in it. Anyway, it makes me think of like how ahead of its time was that movie. I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't hold up if I went back and rewatched it now. But I remember it having a big effect on me in the '90s because. You know, this pre 9/11,
yeah,
obviously pre COVID, pre a lot of things, but it was like The Trigger Effect was a movie about what if there was a blackout,
right?
Lost power in Los Angeles,
and yeah,
everybody lost their ever loving minds,
yeah, yeah,
and because the blackout lasts so long that all of society just collapses. And again, I don't know if the movie holds up, I haven't watched it since '96 or
I'm gonna, whatever. You know, just because you said that, Jeff, I'll try checking it out next week.
Have you never seen it?
David I've never Kep's seen directed. It. I've never seen it. Yeah. And David Koepp, I know, very controversial writer.
Controversial?
Director. Well, I just mean he's made some truly horrible things. But he's also
and
made
yet
some
of the best movies ever
yeah,
made.
I know.
Come on.
This guy has some of the best movies and some of the worst movies ever made.
You're taking those swings.
Yeah, you know, he wrote the Brian De Palma Mission Impossible, right?
Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park. I even like the – did he do Stir of Echoes? Was that him?
Forget if that was
yeah,
him.
Stir of Echoes, the Kevin Bacon. You know, enjoyed that one. You know, but War of the Worlds. Like he's been responsible for a lot of the sci-fi and genre stuff that we have seen over the course of our lives. Yeah. Also made some very bad movies, like Tom Cruise's The Mummy. You know, and so it's like
I mean, some people like.
I feel like sometimes the screenwriter has very little power.
The Eternals of the monster franchise, basically.
Yeah. You know? The Dark Universe.
Of the Dark Universe.
The Eternals was the only Marvel movie that had been made.
But the stuff Kep has been doing recently with Soderbergh, like, you know, I'm a fan. I'm generally a fan.
Good stuff. Yeah. Loved
I mean,
it.
One of them wasn't that good.
Every single one was a banger.
Every single one was a banger.
If I am very very excited for you to watch The Trigger Effect just because I don't have to now. But I really can't wait to hear what you think of it because that's one of those movies that also, you know, has stayed in my head for decades. And I've never revisited this movie, but it came out, you know, at a very impressionable time in my life. And again, before the world felt so fragile, you know, like I think it's hard to express this to people that are younger than me.
I see. You're saying it didn't used to feel as fragile as it does today is what you're saying.
That's the 90s were a precious time.
Yeah. Anything that happened pre 9/11, like 9/11 was this weird breaking point culturally, I think, where we're like, oh, one event can just upend everything.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And, you know, when you see a movie that's sort of about one event upending everything before that's actually happened to you in your life.
Yeah.
It's, I think, very.
It's like a,
you know, it's very. It affects you, and that movie affected me, and it was. It felt very plausible in a weird way. And I'm very curious if you still think it's the way it plays out is plausible.
Okay.
The gang watches.
I'll watch it.
This
I've always
movie.
Wanted to watch it. Also, by the yeah. way, in my opinion, Trigger Effect, really cool name for a movie. I have to
great
say.
Cast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great cast. I mean, Elizabeth Shue and her like looking smoking hot as usual. And just it's back in a time when Dermot Mulroney was a huge star in the world. You know, yeah. That's cool.
All right. I'm doing it. Trigger Effect next week on the what we've been watching. But anyway, probably a better movie than The Last House, which is very ridiculous and silly, and yet also does capture family dynamics, in my opinion, really well. There's just like a, you know, another movie that kind of did the same thing, obviously, was Station 11, where yeah. Mm-hmm. Where you're trapped inside with these people for yeah. a long period of time, right? Your family, your friends, whoever you're staying with, if you're lucky enough to have that, right? Mm-hmm. And
Station 11 being an excellent show.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. And
perhaps the best expression of like that, yeah. post-COVID response. Yeah.
There was a line from Station 11 that I always quote. It's like, you know, it may come to pass that this like strange and terrible time was like the best time of our lives, or it was something like that, where it's like
yeah.
it captures all these contradictions of this is one of the most horrifying things to ever happen, and yet some of the stuff that comes out of it or some of the moments that you had are actually quite meaningful.
I've said that to my wife a number of times, that I look back now on the COVID couple of years with a weird fondness, because I was sequestered with my family. We had this very intense bonding. I had very, yeah. very young children at that time. And it was, yeah, I mean, it's easy to forget the constant anxiety and worry right. that you had, and just remember like, oh my gosh, we didn't have any where to go. We didn't have anything to do. We just were yeah. with mm-hmm. each other. And it was this kind of very pure distillation of family for that period
yeah,
of time.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree, Jeff. Obviously not everyone's experience, right? Some people had a really horrifying, traumatizing experience, especially if you're a medical worker. But everyone had a different experience. And I think The Last House captures what some people's experience of that time was. And then it goes into extremely ridiculous sci-fi tropes that I'm not going to get into. But overall, I would say not a great film. But, you know, sometimes you see movies that aren't great and they do one thing really well. And so I got to give it a shout out. That's The Last House on Netflix. Devendra, something else you've been watching this week?
Yeah, just want to shout out The Dink, which I know you talked about, Jeff, but I saw it, the Apple TV Plus comedy starring Jake Johnson. I really love this movie. I think it's funny. It's sweet. Like it does feel like a throwback to the 90s comedies, like you were saying, Jeff, but I feel like kind of in a good way, kind of like I just like the vibes of it. Jake Johnson is very good. It's really funny. Like almost every scene is doing something interesting and kind of funny and kind of throws things at you, like the random other people he's playing pickleball with. I think it's really smart, really funny, and really sweet too. And yeah, it does take like a romantic turn, but I also feel like that's very much, oh man, that's kind of what a man child would kind of do, right? Like you're gonna latch on to the one bit of like affection you're feeling while you're feeling so sad about your life. It's kind of relatable in many ways too, like as you're getting on the years and you're wondering about your place in your career or whatever. I feel like there's a lot of heart in this movie and something that, you know, everybody can kind of relate to here. So I really like The Dink. David, recommend you check it out.
I remember Jeff's issue with the movie was that The Dink kind of had a hard turn into this, what was it? Spring romance? What is it called? May December romance?
May yeah. December, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I had never heard of that term before that movie, by the way, so I'm still new to it. But yes, Jeff didn't love that component of it, if I recall correctly, right, Jeff?
Well, I just thought it mm-hmm. became less funny and kind of got hijacked by that plot yeah. a little bit. But I ultimately was pretty positive about the movie.
It's got about it. Lost people. Like they're both lost people who are like trying to rebuild their lives in a way too. It is weird. It is weird to see. You know, how old is Jake Johnson now, right? 30-something guy, like romantically paired with Mary Steenburgen. But then also, you see Mary Steenburgen in this movie. You're like, yes, everybody has a crush on her. She's adorable. Like, she's great. She has, like, such a burst of energy and joy. I get it. I can kind of get, like, why this happened. Yeah. It felt very natural to me.
That's The Dink. It's on Apple TV. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more What We've Been Watching right after this. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've been watching.
Yeah, we don't have to talk about it a ton, but I finally got around to watching The Social Dilemma. I can't even speak today. I finally got around to watching The Social...
That was your Adele Dazeem right there.
The Social Dilemma, which is a, at this point, I would say possibly notorious documentary. We ended up watching... Have you guys both seen this? I assume you have.
Yeah.
From 2020, The Social Dilemma. This is a documentary about...
Yes, I think
our
so.
Our culture now, our world. And basically interviews a lot of former employees of the big tech companies talking about how technology has been formulated to be addictive and formulated to sort of perform a social experiment on ourselves. It is a wild, wild raising of the mirror to what is happening to all of us right now and has been for the last, you know, 15 years. We sat down with my son and watched it. I had not seen it. We did not pre-screen it before watching it, but we sat down with my son to watch it. And it was not an easy watch for sure for him as someone, you know, a kid who's 9, about to be 10, and, you know, enamored with all sorts of technology and devices and wants to be on them all the time. We don't allow any, he doesn't have a cell phone. We don't allow any of that stuff, but it's still the pull, the tug is there. And we wanted to kind of give him some context. And I don't, you know, it's hard. I don't know. My dad, when I was a kid, there's a old, I think late 70s, early 80s documentary you guys may have heard of called Scared Straight.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
And he sat me down and watched that. And so this is like our version of Scared Straight. It's almost quaint now to think of Scared Straight as like, hey, if you do something bad, there's going to be consequences that are not right. Good. You know, nowadays it's like, if you do something good, there will be consequences.
Well, if you engage in normal daily activities, like using
your exactly
phone.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Something if you do what everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
God help us all. but, you know, as a movie to just kind of discuss The Social Dilemma, if you have not seen it, I cannot recommend it higher, even if I don't think it is, you know, without its flaws, I'll say mm-hmm. that. There's a weird, like, narrative film embedded in The Social Dilemma that I think is unnecessary and maybe is just there to pad out the length. I don't know, but it's a little trite and kind of pandering and weird, and it doesn't work in my opinion. Jimmy Olsen's in it though. But yeah, it's a weird like dramatization of some of the principles that they're talking about, some of the dangers that they're, you know, explaining. It's like, oh, look, can't you see how this works with a mom and her son and their family and the dinner table? And it's like, okay, we get it without you having to do that. Just give us the people explaining the thing. I don't need to have it dramatized for me because it just feels very almost condescending.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it feels like it should be essential viewing for every human on Earth because you realize how intentional all of this is and has been. The addiction that we all feel to devices, the way it, you know, I think one of the sort of light bulb moments, of which there are many in this documentary, but one of the light bulb moments was, you know, why do you get an alert on your phone that you got a new email? Why doesn't it just show you the email? You know, it's like, well, because what they want is for you to go to do the thing. They want you to stop what you're doing and go do the thing instead of just being able to see the thing. And, you know, there's lots of stuff like that where like, this was all intentionally made. It interviews the people who are like, yeah, we just exploited the psychology of human beings to our own benefit. And then the wildest part is that you can imagine an alien species that wanted to subjugate humanity, you know, launching a plot, like a comic book movie or a science fiction novel would, you know, they would say, oh, they're going to the evil empire is going to come and subjugate human beings in this very nefarious fashion. It's like, well, what actually happened is that we didn't need any outside force. We literally decided to launch the nefarious plot on ourselves. And all the people who even did it at the time are also the targets. They did it to themselves in real time. They launched the thing and were subject to the thing. They're not outside the thing. It's like an entire species on planet Earth decided it was just going to subjugate itself. It's very disturbing. And I,
because it makes a lot, a certain segment of that, those people very rich.
That's right.
And very powerful. So,
but even those rich people are subject
they are
to the principles because it's
they're certainly living in the world that that created.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so, yeah.
They would love not to.
Which they're, which they're now dealing with in the form of everyone hating data centers, you know, but, this reminds me of this post that recently came to my attention from Hacker News in 2019 from the guy who designed, helped design Netflix's autoplay feature. You know how when you get to the end of a TV show or film and then Netflix will be like, hey, we're just going to start playing the next thing. And they were optimizing for hours watched and retention. They would come up with these ideas. And if the feature didn't increase hours watched or retention, the feature was removed. And he says here, quote, autoplay massively increased hours watched. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was by far the biggest increase in the hours watched KPI of any feature we ever tested. There was some skepticism about whether the number was inflated by Netflix by continuing to play when the user left the room. As part of the autoplay, we tested how long the countdown should be between episodes. 5 seconds, 10 seconds, or 15 seconds. 10 seconds caused the biggest increase in hours watched. We thought it gave people time to digest what they just watched, but it wasn't too fast, like 5 seconds, where it became jarring. Interestingly, Netflix recently changed the countdown between episodes to 5 seconds.
Yeah.
That means they tested it out and found more people watched with a shorter countdown. That didn't used to be the case. Netflix users have become conditioned to expect autoplay, end quote. I just love that that anecdote of how they tested it and they had 10 seconds at first. And that was good for people to have like a little thoughtfulness and like process and then move on. And now 10 seconds is too
long. Fuck thoughtfulness.
Now it's like, give me the next thing. Give me the 5 seconds. Now it's 5 seconds before.
Well, one of the big points that they make in the social dilemma as well is that they very much have the dials.
Yeah.
And they could just, and they can just dial human behavior as they see fit. And the guy's like, we literally can sit there and do that and be like, hey, do you want to force people to buy a little more stuff? Here we can. It is literally, you know, hacking the human consciousness in ways that we can't think ourselves out of. It's just, it is so innately ingrained in our evolutionary state that we are prone to these kinds of things that we're powerless to sort of, you know, one of the epiphanies I had watching it was, you know, you think, you hear people say, oh, it's addictive. You know, this is an addictive thing. And I've always sort of had a narrow definition of addiction in that, you know, like chemical addiction to, let's say, nicotine or whatever, where it's like, well, no, this thing your body sort of starts to need and crave on a molecular level. And it's like, oh, no, that is what is happening. Because it is the same kind of thing where we evolved to need these kind of social cues to survive. We evolved culturally to need this feedback, to be social creatures, to have this kind of these things that scratch certain itches as in very rare ways. And the reason that we evolved to need them in the same way that we evolved to need sugar or whatever these other kind of addictive substances are is because they were infrequent. And so, you know, we developed this kind of natural desire to have them so that we would seek them out, right? And have evolutionary benefit. Well, the same thing is happening here. And if you just drink from the fire hose of any one of these things, your body's like, yes, I need that. And now I'm addicted to it because I'm getting so much more of this thing that used to be rare evolutionarily. So there's no difference. It's exactly the same it is a molecular level of addiction, and it's very disturbing.
It's very, you got to think, like, it's your attention. Like, that's all these companies are fighting for, like, doing whatever it takes to command your attention, to hold your attention. And the thing that's very real now is that you have to be more intentional about how, like, you use things, especially as parents. Like, you can't just, like, put the kids in front of the TV, which was never a great idea. But now it's, like, very dangerous in many ways if you just, like, let them go free on technology. And hopefully that's something we're all kind of learning. Hopefully we'll see stronger regulation down the line.
One more quick point that I thought was powerful was there's never been a product that wants something of you. That we used to just, you'd buy a thing. He's like, there's a difference between a tool that you purchase and you use, and it gives you benefit in your life. That is a tool that sits there waiting for you to use it. You buy a hammer or any other tool, it provides utility for when you need it. These are things that beg for you. They need you. They are asking something of you. Come to me. I need you to do this. They're not tools. They're something else. And it's having that sort of recontextualization of these devices is very powerful. And I think something that should be essential viewing for everybody.
That's The Social Dilemma. Jeff, do you remember how you watched this one?
It's on Netflix.
On Netflix. And it's something Jeff Gunnell has been watching.
I watched it because like 5 seconds passed and I was just had to watch whatever was next.
You were watching The Audacity.
That's right.
It was like,
Whatever my algorithm tells me, just tell me.
Just give me the next thing, please. I don't want to do any thinking. I don't do any thinking. All right. That is what we've been watching this week. Let's do a few weekly plugs. We're going to do weekly plugs. Plugs. Weekly plugs, a part of Shit Each Week where we plug something else we've been making. I want to throw a shout out for this piece at Decoding Everything, the newsletter that I run. It's free. You can subscribe at decodingeverything.com. Matt Goldberg recently wrote a piece about the 5 lessons from the 2026 summer movie season that shares some lessons we've learned from the box office and how things performed well and how things didn't perform well. I thought it was very insightful. I agree with pretty much all the conclusions. Check it out at decodingeverything.com. Devinder Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Yeah, over at Engadget, I wrote a piece about why curved TVs failed. It's something I always ask to write because I'm not really thinking about this question very much, but it seems kind of obvious. But yeah, I talked to one person who has worked with TV manufacturers. Kind of a mess. It just kind of came and went, but we have curved gaming monitors now, and I feel like that's where the technology works best. So yeah, check out that piece in Engadget.
You know, I've tried like every single type of monitor to maximize my productivity. And I do have a white whale that I haven't yet tried yet. I don't know. There's this one that's like 51 or 52 inches from Samsung.
Nope.
Do you know what I mean?
The Odyssey?
There is one I could tell you about.
No, not that
week.
One. It's the one that's like even, it's like regular dimensions. I have an ultra wide Odyssey right now.
Yeah,
me too. But I don't. I will get the name.
I'm looking at one right now, which I consider the sweet spot of what you want a monitor to can be, but I can't tell you about it until next week. So,
exciting! I love my Odyssey Neo. I love it. I've never loved a monitor like I love this.
They're
monitor.
They're not tall enough. That's the thing. Like you
the Odyssey Arc. Yeah. That's the one it is. Yeah. The Samsung
55 inch
Odyssey Arc. That's the one that I'm like. I've never tried it. It seems like a huge...
Feels too big.
I reviewed it. No.
Yeah, I don't think it would actually be good for me.
Is that why you didn't like it, Devinder? Is it too big?
That one was too big, and also like it can tilt vertical and portrait too, which is kind of interesting.
It can tilt and fold. Like it can kind of like fold and curve towards you.
It's not that great for actual...
You can kiss your neck at night and... It can
if you want a game in front of that thing, your neck's all over the place. Like you need actually like a focused screen area for you to play shooters and stuff.
But you ever have one of those where you're like, I don't think that actually is going to work for my workflow, but like, I still want to try that, That's the Samsung 55-inch Odyssey Arc for me.
Would not recommend it.
Yeah, but, I don't think it would be good for me at all, and it costs, according to Samsung, $2,700.
Probably doesn't cost that anymore.
Yeah, you can get it for like about $1,000 right now.
Yeah.
And I think I would have a 55-inch paperweight in the house if I got it.
That thing also came to me on a pallet. You know how many things come on the pallets?
Yeah.
Big things. Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah.
Anyway, Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
Well, the newest episode of my video game podcast, DLC, is episode 666.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm here to dare you all to listen to it. I dare you to listen to episode 666. The Sign of the Beast. Anyway, we just talk about video games in it. But still, I dare you to listen to it. Our guest is Anthony Taormina from Game Rant. Always a great guest. He flew to Japan, to Tokyo, to play Duskbloods, the new Switch 2 exclusive From Software game everybody's buzzing about. So he gives us the lowdown on that, and we talk about a lot of other really interesting, cool things. So check it out, DLCpod.com.
Of course, I want to throw a shout out for our Patreon at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Patrons have gotten episodes of the podcast early. They get them ad-free, and they also get weekly bonus After Dark episodes. So be sure to check it out at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Of course, we never want you to donate if it in any way causes you financial hardship. You can support us for free by leaving a star rating for us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to everyone who supports the show in any way. And as we get to our review of Tony, I do just have a question for you guys. When you're in a kitchen, do you guys know how to get the dishwasher loaded?
Hello?
Mr. Bourdain, the committee has decided to go with another student for the fellowship.
Fuck! I need a job.
You work in a kitchen before?
Sorry.
Yeah.
We open Wednesday to Sunday. Start 11 a.m.
What fucking time is it?
That means that you are here at 10:45. 11 is late. Anyone late is fired.
You know I can cook too.
The kid said he's a cook, Jeff.
I'm actually not a fucking cook. I'm a writer. But I said I know how to cook.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand that. Shut the fuck up. I
see. None of that was
I don't care, Tony.
You give him a 12-pack. You give him a 12-pack. Welcome to the film.
Yeah, I forgot the setup.
What'd you say, Jeff?
I said I forgot the setup.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay because, you know, for us on the podcast, for us recording, there's actually a big break between the trailer playing and then when we just, but for the listener at home, it was almost instantaneous, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'm sure they loved it.
Welcome to the Filmcast review of Tony, the newest film by Matt Johnson. I'm going to read the plot summary of this movie from IMDb. A 19-year-old Anthony Bourdain travels to Provincetown and stumbles into the chaotic world of a restaurant kitchen, setting off a summer that will shape the course of his life, end quote. Now, I do want to point out before we begin this review that this movie is not based on a true story in the conventional sense of the term. It is a reimagining.
There are two stories in here.
Yeah, there are true stories, or I would describe them as elements of true stories in here.
Yeah.
But they are reimagining what a summer of Tony Bourdain's life would look like. And reading here from the Hollywood Reporter, Bourdain's estate released a statement offering insight into the decision to give their blessing to this film, saying, "We chose to support Tony because it is not a standard biopic and doesn't attempt to summarize his life. Guided by the vision of director Matt Johnson, the film depicts one transformative summer in 1975 in Provincetown, Massachusetts. It is an interpretation, as that part of Tony's life will always remain somewhat unknown," end quote. So just wanted to make that clear going in, like, mm-hmm. not only what the movie's trying to do, but also that the Bourdain estate has blessed it and shared, not only blessed it, but shared their opinion on why they blessed it, which is, it doesn't attempt to summarize their whole life. And so just worth noting as we dive into this film, we don't necessarily think this movie, events transpired exactly in the way that this movie depicts them. The Victor Hardaway.
Most movies that are biopics, it happened exactly
like that. I mean, there's no changes whatsoever. we can talk about that. We can talk about that. Because in my opinion, I actually like that they're like, hey, this is definitely all made up. Like, and other biopics, you know, you joke, Jeff, but many biopics aspire to verisimilitude, or they use verisimilitude as one of their marketing points, and this movie does not. And I think that is worth noting. Devendra Hardwar, your thoughts on Tony?
I love this movie, but not because I'm a fan of Anthony Bourdain. You know, I've talked about his work. I love the man's work and everything he did, really. This movie is like trying to capture the spirit of somebody who would become the Anthony Bourdain that we know. It's a very weird thing, right? It's most biopics do not try to do this. It kind of reminds me of the Steve Jobs movie that what's his face did?
Aaron Sorkin.
The Aaron Sorkin written one. And because it's like, it's, you're really wrestling with the ideas of this person while also trying to build like a really good dramedy. I think ultimately this is just like a very good coming of age story of somebody who doesn't quite know themselves, is kind of angry at the world. I think it's very relatable, right? It's about that moment in your 20s, in your late teens, where you discover yourself. And I think everybody has that, or at least everybody is working through so many things to try to get that moment, to figure out basically what you want to do with the rest of your life. And I think this movie captures that really well. Dominic Sessa, who is incredible here. He is definitely, I feel like he has just carved out the little niche of playing a little shit that you just kind of want to, you can't hate him completely, right? There is something there. There's something sensitive about him that's kind of interesting too. So perfectly cast here. It is funny how much of this movie, the girl from Coda is in this movie, right? Oscar winning movie, best picture winner Coda is in this movie, and they align so well, actually, because it's also another coming of age story of somebody in a seaside town who's trying to figure themselves out, has a Spanish speaking mentor who's trying to show them the way through life. I think this movie is a lot more successful than that one is, because it's funnier.
You're like, saying this movie goes to Dynamite.
Yeah.
You're saying this movie is more successful than the best picture award winning film.
That's one of the best pictures ever made.
I'm going to put this out there. Okay. Look, Jeff, I know you like this movie, but Coda winning best picture for being a 2021 film is the clearest example, in my opinion, that we were going through some kind of mass psychosis.
We're just going through it. We're all going through it.
That's all
I
have to say about that. Okay, so
but anyway, opinion on Coda, as we all know.
I've let it out.
It's just funny how much they align. But no, I find this movie really funny, very relatable. This is like a career best turn for Antonio Banderas. Like he has become sort of like a wise elder in a lot of films recently, and I think he is perfect here. Supporting cast to like Stavros Halkias, I think, is very good in this, kind of just doing his thing. But it also has a great sense of place. It also has a reverence for the idea of food and cooking and kind of the work that goes into it, but also kind of how it brings people together. And that's what Bourdain did well. That's what Bourdain did well, better than anybody else, right? There have always been travel shows. There were always food shows. But what he did is like weave that line between humanity and culture and society through the lens of food. And he did it better than anybody else. And he was also a great writer. He's also somebody who cared a lot about words and what he used and how he used them. So this movie positioning this kid is like, I want to be a writer, like trying really hard to figure that out. I think it all kind of works. Like, so I ultimately, I love this movie. There's some stuff we could talk about in spoilers, because some things that you think are not true in this movie come directly from Kitchen Confidential. And there are things that have like lingered in my mind, like, oh man, it's insane if that actually happened. According to Bourdain, certain things actually happened. But anyway, freaking love this movie.
I will say that Matt Johnson, who's one of the co-writers of this film, was saying that when they were researching the movie, they found that some of what was in Kitchen Confidential had been embellished, right?
Sure,
and so how accurate things are, the truth is never fully knowable. I do think it is worth going into this movie with that skepticism. Jeff Cannata.
I mean, the movie depicts a bold-faced liar, so
Yeah.
You take that for what
you will.
He's
the man who would become Anthony yeah. Bourdain. You know, very, very much like
he was only starting to refine his lying skills at the time.
Yeah.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on Tony?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts on Tony are best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Let's hear it, Jeff.
You can make a compelling portrait from a slice of life, not all of it, just enough to explain how young asshole Bourdain became slightly less of a shit.
That was very, very good, Jeff. That's like top tier, top tier.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I agree right down the line with Devendra. I also love this movie. Right at this moment, unprecedented, there are two movies from the same director on my top 10 of the year list.
Wow. In one year, right? In one year.
In the same year. Yeah. That's never happened before.
Yeah.
I've just become so enamored with Matt Johnson's work. I love how this movie's shot. I love every decision of where the camera is placed and how, you know, the frame is muddied. He puts the camera behind stuff, but you're looking through things. It's just, I love his eye.
Yeah, often when he's shooting a conversation, right? You do over the shoulder shot, but the way he shoots it often, the person whose face you're not seeing is occupying like 80% of the frame often the time. And it's a really interesting way of, you know, using negative space in these, and like who actually is the main character in the scene, and you know,
and you're frequently in this movie, you're stuck inside a kitchen and you're behind utensils and pots and pans. You feel like almost a voyeur in the world. He places you in that kitchen, but not even just the kitchen. It's this entire sort of idyllic summer town, you know, one of the things Devendra mentioned that I totally agree with is that this movie has a wonderful sense of place, and it just captures that feeling of that one summer when we just were in this place that's not normal. It's not our usual life. And I've had that before where, you know, you're whatever it is, you're at camp or you went on a vacation or you went to and there's just this sense of this bottle that you're inside that is special, and that there's a magic spell cast and it's not going to last forever. It's only going to be a couple of months or whatever. And the movie does that so, so well. But, you know, I also love the fact that this didn't have to even be about Anthony Bourdain.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So many biopics, you know, it's Elton John, and it only matters because you care about Elton John. And like, let's figure out how Elton John became Elton John. Wow,
and that's cool. We got to have the music of Elton John in there.
And we're going to see these actors do the songs because it's just like, well, how did Elton John get to be? How did Michael Jackson get? It requires your interest in the subject matter.
Right.
It really only exists because of our interest in the subject matter. It's like, there's this thing that we know. How did that happen? This movie could have just been a narrative movie that worked. It works as just a standalone film, completely disconnected from any real person or events. It just works as a movie. And I think that is a strength. Like I'm not a huge Anthony Bourdain fan. I haven't read Kitchen Confidential or anything. And, I think it is interesting that it's loosely based on a real person, but so it's additive rather than substantive. It's rather than sort of just needs to be in order to prove this thing should exist at all. It's a movie and a really good one. I'm like Devendra, impressed with Dominic Sessa. I liked him in, The Holdovers, and he really has carved out this sort of tortured, you know, ennui personality really, really well. He's just, you know, kind of grumbling his way through this movie, and that could not work. You know, that could be an annoying thing to hang out with somebody, you know, through a whole movie who's that way, and somehow this kid's charm shines through that. I'm also, as you guys know, as I keep saying over and over again, I have become a huge fan of Leo Woodall.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm huge. I talked about it with Tuner. I talked about it. You know, I discovered him on that that TV series One Day. You know, even Nuremberg, I was like, I love this kid. I think he has a bright future. He's great here.
Amazing.
I love that he's willing to play, you know, not the lead in this movie. He's yeah. clearly a lead actor in a lot of films, and he comes in and does such a great job of playing a real, you know, character role here. It's just a movie that you can luxuriate in. You just want to be with these people. You want to hang out. It's a hang movie for lot of it. You know, there's all these scenes of just like being at dinner and people joking around, and you're just like in this world. And Matt Johnson does such a great job of making that appealing, but also kind of dangerous, kind of dark. You know, there's a lot of, like I was joking about earlier, there's a lot of lies and mistruths and manipulation that's happening here that feels kind of icky, but it all really, really works. And Antonio Banderas is great. Mm-hmm. I came out of this movie completely buzzing. Like I said, it's in my top 10 of the year right now. I love Matt Johnson. I hope he keeps making more great movies, because I think he's one of my favorite directors right now, frankly.
Jeff, remind me, have you seen Blackberry? Did we talk about that?
Yeah. No, yeah, I yeah, love yeah, that. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah, yeah. yeah. Guys, thank God, finally a movie we all like.
Oh, God. I was worried.
Because it's been a while. No, I really like this as well. I agree with everything you guys have said. Jeff, I agree with your statement about you don't need to know who Anthony Bourdain is to enjoy this film, which is, like, in my opinion, the sign of a good film. Yeah. There is a tiny, like, 0.001% of, you know, Member Berry-style stuff with this that we can discuss in spoilers. But overall, you don't need to know anything about Anthony Bourdain's career or life to really appreciate what's going on here. There is not much new in terms of coming-of-age stuff in this film, but in my opinion, it is executed at an extremely high level. A couple things worth calling out. Dominic Sessa, I mean, what a career this guy has had. Imagine The Holdovers is the first movie you've ever made. So you're acting with Academy Award winner Paul Giamatti. Then you make Now You See Me film, which, you know, we don't need to talk about that. But and then you're in, you know, you're starring in this new movie with Matt Johnson directing and Antonio Banderas.
As one of the most beloved people ever lived.
Yeah. The woman from Best Picture award winning film Coda is your co-star. You know, like, he's kind of like, you used to hear these stories growing up of, casting agent pulled him out of obscurity and he became a huge star. He's living that story. There's not that many of them anymore, right? That doesn't happen very often anymore, but he's one of the people that's like living that. And I do think you guys are right. He is walking a really thin line because he is playing a character that could be extremely hateable, but he plays it in a way that
does despicable things.
Yeah, does horrifying things. Yeah.
Over and over.
Plays it in a way that you actually want to root for him to be better, and that is really, really nice. The way that this movie makes these different characters like represent, as far as I understand, they are representations of ideas of people that Anthony Bourdain encountered, right? Like, there is no like single wise old chef that imparts wisdom to Anthony Bourdain in real life, but it's like he's an amalgamation of a bunch of different chefs. Leo Woodall's character represents a bunch of different chefs that Anthony Bourdain has met. And
Anthony Bourdain did Coke with.
Right. Yeah. Right. And they did the movie did such a good job of like making these ideas of people into people who actually feel like real humans that have full inner lives. And there are also just like a handful of sequences that are just really well made from a filmmaking perspective. Like there's a montage that happens.
Yeah. So
when
good.
He's like first like learning how to be in the restaurant, that's just like really, really well done. And so, yeah, it's just from top to bottom, this is not like a groundbreaking coming of age story, but it is a regular coming of age story that we all know and love, done at an extremely high level. Just like this is like the top of the top of what you can get for this type of story. And as a result, I'm a huge fan. I found it very moving. And Matt Johnson, 2 for 2 this year. Incredible, incredible work.
And so different, the movies.
Oh, I mean, not even recognizable.
Yeah. Right?
Like, but anyway.
Also, My friend Rich Sommer's in this movie.
And yay.
I'm always happy to see Rich getting work. He's awesome.
All right, let's get the spoilers for Tony starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
So, Jeff, the one sort of little thing that felt like it was Sam L. Jackson stepping out and being like, I'm putting together a team for the Avengers initiative was Eric at the Rivera. Very, very end when he says, Anthony, like, what's your name?
I know.
Anthony Bourdain. You know, it's like, I know,
but
now
I forgave that. It's like,
he's called himself Tony for the whole movie, but like people, but Antonio Banderas is like, you should call yourself Anthony. It's cleaner.
For a grown up. For a man.
You're right that only lands because that's a famous name that we know from fame.
But
from
it's such a small part of the movie.
It's the title. It's earned with the title. Like, it's a whole thing of like him, he's become a different person.
Right.
And
I
forgave that. But you're right. It is only there because we know that name.
Yeah.
I mean, you give it a little bit of that. I will say, for fans of Bourdain, though, I think this movie hits a lot different, too, because that guy did not have an easy life. He was not always good to himself. You know, he suffered through addiction for decades. Like, he became famous in his, like, late 40s, right? But it was decades of working in shitty kitchens. Like, he did go to the CIA. Like, he did train to be a chef, but he was never, like, a world-famous great chef. He was a guy doing grunt work who eventually was the executive chef at Le Hal, which was just like a typical neighborhood bistro type of deal, like just like a normal everyday restaurant. There was nothing special about him, but he did spend decades dealing with drug addiction and things. And watching this movie, I'm like, oh man, it's genuinely sad because there is like, you see the forces he's fighting kind of against, right? Leo Woodall is sort of like the devil on his shoulder, being like, let's party, man. Let's go have a good time. Anthony Banderas is like, there is something here too. Like, there is something good here with the food that you can find. You can see like the personality of somebody who's been wrestling with this like his entire life. And even after he became famous, like it was tumultuous. Like, his romantic spirit is kind of what we follow in this movie, but also led him away from his marriage and to things that like led to like his untimely death. And I think it's tragic in a way. Like, this movie reads a lot more tragic if you know the life of the guy who lived it.
Right.
The other thing is the tiniest bit misleading. I always love it when a movie at the end shows you the real picture of the real people, but it does seem to indicate like it's a one-to-one. Here's the three people.
It's based off of this true story, but in fact, it's not the case. I did not like that as well. And I honestly, like, the text on the end and everything like that, again, also implies, like, the text at the end is true, so it implies, like, what has come before is true as well. I don't like that either. Like, if they just ended the movie, I think that would have been fine.
And the picture specifically is, like, here are these specific humans that you saw in this movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Don't love it. I'm fine. Yeah. I'm fine with them embracing, like, we're making all this up, and that's fine. But don't love that they tried to, like, make nods towards verisimilitude. I think the Sal character played by Leo Woodall is so compelling, right? Because he represents this hedonistic, unstable lifestyle that can feel so attractive. And you see how during the montage, when he's teaching him how, quote unquote, how to be a man, how to like use his lighter and do all these things, that can be very intoxicating for a young man who's directionless. One of my favorite moments in the movie is when they're at the bar and the girl that he's after, Nancy, comes in with her boyfriend, and Sal's like, hey, we got to get out of here. And they start leaving. And then Sal just shoves Tony into Nancy's boyfriend. And then before that,
he's like very genial with the bartender. It's like, hey, put it on my tab. He's like, sure thing, buddy. Everything's great. Escalates into complete chaos.
Right. It's like so effortless.
Yes.
The way he like knows exactly what he's about to do. Like he knows the choreography of how he's going to do this. He shoves Tony into the boyfriend, and then like immediately starts like attacking him after like he retaliates. That was like, wow. Like you can tell that guy has like, he has complete mastery of this situation. Like he has, he is Neo in the Matrix. Sal is Neo in the Matrix of this situation.
And I just bartender's like, oh, he's at it again. Right, even though I like him sometimes. So, yeah.
It was such a wonderful, cause it just happens like, it's like 3 seconds long, this moment. And it just happens so quickly. It's like, wow, that guy, you just get such a vivid illustration of that character from that one scene. You know?
The other, totally agree. That scene's amazing. The other one with him, you know, where he actually punches Antonio Banderas, which also comes out of nowhere. These like explosive moments of, he's just late, you know? And of course, you know, we make a big deal about Antonio Banderas not allowing people to be late, but that, that explosion of like, oh, this isn't just a transgression. This is the end of their relationship. Mm-hmm. It's such a big moment that comes out of nowhere. I love how that plays out because
he's late because of the drug bender too, right? Yeah, so it's like his own like moral failing is like what's tearing this all apart. Yeah. He's very good in this, but also, man, it's like, no wonder so many young guys are just like finding the worst role models, right? Like us, like them, or somebody like a, you know, this is how people get to Joe Rogan or something, like, oh, look at these cool masculine guys. Just, they own the world. They could do whatever. They could sleep whatever girls they want. They could, they do anything just to be a man. Yeah. It's so intoxicating and it's so, oh man, it's sad.
I did enjoy how much the film communicates about Anthony Bourdain's family without saying anything. The 80s, what an amazing time. Can you imagine you could just leave home?
Yeah.
Unreachable. Not say anything. And then literally your parents can't do anything.
They don't know where you are. They have no way of tracking you.
They have no way of tracking you.
This is mid-70s. Mid-70s, not even 80s.
Okay, sorry, mid-70s, yeah. Hope you call back. And it's like, what are they going to do? Like, put out an APB? Like, it's...
Yeah,
you could be anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
There's something freeing to that.
We truly had everything. You know, what a time it was to be alive back then. Right?
I love that we get so little of the family dynamic, but it's also like you could tell like his mom is over his shit. Like it's a very, he feels trapped there, but also it's just two parents trying to take care of them. He's like, I don't like this.
They're like genuinely loving, kind people.
Yeah.
Well, his mom is a little overbearing and can be kind of a jerk sometimes, but there's like, you don't see her like being abusive to him or anything like that. Like she's just a little overbearing, right? It's kind of what it seems.
You could tell that she is kind of over his shit, right?
His
like cockiness, and he's like, you can't go through the world like this. His mom, by the way, who is an editor at the New York Times. So it's like, that's where her love of language and everything comes in. And like that leads to
building Roman, you know,
love it.
That's how you
love
it. But yeah, she's not buying anything he's selling. And you growing up under that, you can feel inadequate. Certainly nothing to justify what his actions are actually in the film.
Yeah.
But like,
it's just funny because there are interviews with Bourdain's parents, like after, like in the 2000s, like after he's been successful, and even the mom's like, I can't believe this is happening. This guy, this kid is a world famous author and TV personality. Incredible.
My dumbass son.
Yeah. My dumbass son. Yeah.
There is a moment in this film. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
No, you can.
The very end of the film, right, was very moving to me because the idea is he sees Leo Woodall's character, Sal, on the beach, and he's framed by all these people around, like blurry people around him. And Sal's like, hey, am I coming back to you? No, I'm not. I'm leaving. Okay, goodbye. And
no, it's like, are you coming to me? That's
right,
the devil calling
to me?
Him.
Sure, are you coming back to me?
It is the devil on the shoulder going, hey, here
you
go.
You want to come back to me? Oh, no, I'm going to go away then. And it's really Tony choosing which path he's going to go in, right?
Yeah.
And it reminded me of something Christopher Nolan said during the Odyssey press tour, where he said, people watch movies and they identify how the mechanics of movie making work. And they think that because they've identified it, that makes those things bad. But it doesn't. So like, just because you know what the filmmaker is doing doesn't make it bad.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, I was watching it and I was like, oh, I know what the filmmaker is doing. Like, this is clearly like visual symbolism he's using of like this guy's in the background. And but it doesn't make it bad. That was a thought that went through my head as I was watching that scene. Like, just because it's very obvious, just because it's very obvious what's happening, doesn't mean it's a bad show.
Not everybody may read that so clearly, you know? So
that's true too.
Yeah, there is that. That's true. That's true. Anyway, yeah. Random thought. All right, Jeff, what were you going to
say? A tiny little thing that tickled me that, you know, I think is the sign of good screenwriting, good filmmaking is the, we have the fun joyride where we're shooting off the fire extinguisher out of the car window, which in the moment just feels like a couple of knuckleheads being dumb.
Oh,
is a perfect setup for the fact that we can't put the fire out later. Just loved that. It's just so perfect.
Yes.
That, you know, that later
that is
on
a
we
tight
pull that
script. That is a tight script
because you know? it doesn't call itself out in the moment as being a setup for anything. It's just this free form expression of, you know,
youth,
recklessness.
Yeah.
But later on, he pulls that and you go, ah, of course the fire extinguisher is empty because these idiots, you know, it's just
these
so
idiots.
Great.
And also he makes it worse by throwing water on the grease fire because he has no idea what he's doing. He's never had kitchen experience. It all kind of comes together. That whole sequence breaks my heart too, by the way. Like I expected to have my heart broken by this movie a little bit because I think Bourdain was ultimately one of the good ones, like somebody out there doing work that was very pro-humanity, very much about revealing other cultures, revealing other people. And he was doing tremendous work. And when he died, it felt like a very necessary voice in the world had gone away.
Yeah.
And at a time where I feel like we kind of needed that criticism. But in this movie specifically, like Chef kind of find Banderas' chef, like kind of finding his groove again. It's like, yeah, I can make something special, right? Like this is great. We can try harder. And it burns down the damn restaurant. Like that's truly sad too. Like that's
the only
way
thing
I thought
about in that moment though was like no one else ordered the special.
Other people did.
Oh, I didn't.
So there were like three other orders for the special, but the first time they make it is like, it's going to take a while. And you can also see like, oh, this is why we don't do the special because it's taken forever to get this thing ready. And like you have like orders coming in, like it's not working, but it's like a beautiful dream that they're chasing. And then the dream falls apart so quickly.
I did like that. In my opinion, ultimately the movie is about the dignity of kitchen work, right? I mean, these people come from all different walks of life and they're all there, but there is something dignified about it. That's obviously what Anthony Bourdain concluded and why he decided to dedicate decades of his life to it. But there is that moment when he confronts Banderas on the beach, right?
Yeah.
And says basically like, you know, bitch, I'm a Vassar student. I wasn't going to be here. Like, and
oh, it's brutal.
It's brutal because I think he... Is it dramatic irony, right? He as the character doesn't know what we know, which is that it is a very special experience what he's been through, but he's too young and inexperienced to realize how special it is. And he's like, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to do all this stuff that's more fancy. And like, I'm not going to lower myself to these menial tasks. But in fact, right, what the movie is trying to say is there's nothing lower about those things, right? That there is dignity and importance in this work. And I really appreciated that. So
A couple of things I want to mention that at least he mentioned in Kitchen Confidential, the thing of him like barehanded grabbing the cast iron pan. That's like a story that he told early on. And somebody just a real chef just coming up and grabbing it barehanded when he's crying for burn cream. Very, very notable experience. Also, the
such
little
a badass
thing that we
moment
get,
in the movie,
just a badass moment. That chef being like, "Come on, kid, like grow up." the wedding party that goes to the restaurant,
true
and
story,
then she sees Leah Whittle's character, and then they end up having sex. That is the story in Kitchen Confidential. That's also one of those things that's just like stuck in my head. Like, imagine if that was actually true, right? Like the bride in her bridal outfit, and that's one of the things that enamored Bourdain with this whole lifestyle. It's like, look what a chef can do. You can do anything. It's kind of wild. So it's funny that they kept that in the movie. I don't know like the actual truth of that, but he did write about that in the book. And it's like, you know, can imagine there's that. Do want to shout out, like, I forget if I've talked about this on the show. We talked about, like, we were talking about Widow's Bay, and I was like, you know, I would love to live in Widow's Bay. I'd love to live in a little seaside town, even if it's a little haunted, even if there's a little blood curse going on, because it's so idyllic. And I think this movie really captures the idyllicness of like living in a seaside town with just like a couple of restaurants. You're chill. You're always by the beach. Like, it really does capture Provincetown quite well. I spent a couple summers in Cape Cod, but nowhere very nice, really. So I've never been to Provincetown, but it is somewhere I've always wanted to go. This movie really sells it.
I did want to give a shout out to the montage of him learning how to, I talked about it a little bit in the pre-spoiler section, but the way that montage marks time is by showing Antonio Banderas dumping buckets of water on Dominic Sessa's head.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And every single one of those shots is a different setup, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think every single shot is, what I mean by that is like, it's a different camera position. It's a different like time of day. Antonio Banderas is wearing a different outfit.
They probably shot one of those every, like every day, right?
Just right. And that shot, like when you see it, I think it's last like less than a second. Mm-hmm. Right. It's maybe 1 to 2 seconds tops, like at most. Right. And that must have, they could have made it easier on himself. Like he could have like, we're just doing one camera position and then we're going to just do this with a bunch of different outfits and just shoot it all in one day. And he decided to not do that. He's like, I want this to, you will physically feel like the passage of time through this montage. And the way they're doing that is like, they're varying the shot composition. And I was just like, wow, like, that is dedication. That is dedication. And you might not even pick up on it, right? Because it happens so fast. Yeah. So anyway, shout out to the montage.
Well, it goes back to what he said with Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie that I just love. In fact, it's not even his own quote. I think he was quoting Penn and Teller, I want to say, when he was saying that, you know, the thing that people don't realize is that, you know, most magic is just somebody's willing to do this. Put more time into this.
Put way more effort into it than you could
necessary.
Possibly imagine.
Yeah,
right?
That's something like, that seems easy is just somebody spent the time to do it.
Yeah.
And you got to appreciate that. You got to appreciate that. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you guys heard Matt Johnson's directing style specifically for Dominic Sessa? He was talking about this in a couple interviews, but he is like, he is always within arm's reach of Dominic Sessa to like sort of like direct him, to mold him, to like do it this way. And that's not something I hear too often, right? Normally the director is at least a little bit outside of like the whole setup and everything, but the hands-on approach I think lends to like, that's what helps this movie feel so vital. Like it's always moving. It's very alive. It's not improv or partially improv like Nirvana was, but it feels almost like it is.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. All right, folks. Well, at the end of the day, it is really impressive that Matt Johnson made a movie. And that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of the Filmcast. You can find more episodes of this show at thefilmcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McCune from The Midnight. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode with video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast, Coyote versus Acme. Coyote
versus
Acme.
They said we couldn't watch it.
They tried to stop us from watching this movie. They failed. And not only are we watching it, we're going to be reviewing it here on the Filmcast. Also, at least Jeff and I will be watching The Dog Stars. So we'll be talking about that during what we've been watching as well. So you can look forward to conversations about those movies next week on the Filmcast. Until then, they are Devendra Hardwar and Jeff Cannata. I'm David Chen. And we'll see you later. Goodbye.